importance of the time that we spend thinking about the Bible this morning. I pray that you would give us a greater understanding of what you want to do in our lives. I pray, Father, that you would give us a deeper appreciation of your greatness and what you can do. And I ask, Father, that you would give us a greater motivation to serve you and to follow your ways. All of this, Father, we pray in the wonderful name of Jesus. Amen. There's a simple and yet profound reality which we often overlook. We live in a world of self-sufficiency and self-help books and self-help gurus. And there's a very simple principle which we often overlook. And it's this, that while we often persist in looking for better methods, God is still intent on making us better ministers, better servants. See, we have this idea that if we can just get the right methods, if we can just do the right things, then almost by definition, we're going to be successful. If we can look at what's happening in the church over here and say, yeah, it's doing well, let's just do what they're doing, and think that somehow we'll necessarily be successful over here. And what we forget is that sometimes methods are not what we need. As a young preacher, I was encouraged to read and to listen to the sermons of the preaching greats of a bygone era. And I cringe, you know, I have a filing cabinet full of old sermons. And every time I find myself getting a bit cocky, I go back and I read them. And you know, even 30 years later, I can still say, oh, I know what book I was reading when I wrote that sermon. And then I got the best piece of advice I think I've ever been given as a preacher. It was in an article called For the Average Preacher. And the writer said simply, don't try to copy Spurgeon or Moody or Billy Graham, because you're not Spurgeon or Moody or Billy Graham. You are, in all likelihood, quite an average preacher. And therefore, be content with that. Be content with what God has made you and seek to use what God has given you. In other words, don't look for better methods. Look to be a better man. That's not to say that we can't learn from others. That's not to say that we shouldn't take notice of what is working in one place, because there are always lessons we can learn. But sometimes in doing that, we miss that bigger principle. So let's look at how this works out in the life of Moses, one of the most incredible, one of the most remarkable men in the Old Testament. And let's see how God worked with him. God is not looking for better methods. He is looking to make us better people. And that, first of all, means that our strengths will not necessarily guarantee our success. The writer of Hebrews, when he's talking about Moses, said that Moses' parents hid him because they could see that he was no ordinary child. And he had no ordinary opportunities in life either. In fact, quite the opposite. Look at what the writer, Exodus 2, excuse me, how Exodus 2 describes his early life. Exodus 2 and verse 1. Now a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the banks of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. This is one of the Hebrew babies, she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you? Yes, go, she answered. And the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take care of this baby, take the baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you. So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, I drew him out of the water. Moses had no ordinary childhood. And God had arranged the circumstances of his life so that even though he was the son of an enslaved nation, even though technically he was condemned to death almost as soon as he was born, he was going to know the privileges of education, of wealth, and of position. He would be close to the seat of power and of influence. He would see what ruling a nation involved. And he would have the influence of a woman of faith, a woman who had risked her own life to protect his. And yet his first attempt as a liberator of his people ended in complete and utter failure. In fact, even worse, it ended in murder and in exile. Pick up the story, verse 11. One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Glancing this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew? The man said, who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid and thought, what I did must have become known. When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now a priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up and came to their rescue and watered the flock. When the girls returned to Reuel, their father, he asked them, why have you returned so early today? They answered, an Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock. The people weren't ready for a liberator. Moses wasn't ready to be their leader. God's timing was not yet. But there seems to be a certain overconfidence in Moses' behavior. It's almost as if it never occurred to him that his fellow countrymen wouldn't accept his leadership. And when it happened, when he realized that his murder of the Egyptian was known, he had no choice but to leave everything that he knew, everything that he held dear, and spend the next 40 years living a wilderness experience, a sojourner, a stranger in a strange land. In fact, he finally married a woman called Zipporah, and when he had a son, he called him Gershom, for I have become an alien in a foreign land, he said. And all that would begin to change on the day he saw a strange phenomenon, a bush that was on fire and yet didn't burn up. He was about to encounter the living God and begin to learn something about his power and about the way he works in the world. Exodus chapter 3, verse 1. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that although the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. Who wouldn't have gone to see something like that? When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you're standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now, go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name by which I am to be remembered from generation to generation. Go, assemble the elders of Israel and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob appeared to me and said, I have watched over you and have seen what has been done to you in Egypt. And I have promised to bring you up out of your misery in Egypt into the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. Moses had already learned that his strengths did not guarantee his success. But there was another crucial lesson which he had to learn. See, God is still interested in building better people. And Moses had to learn that his self-doubts did not disqualify him from service. There's a massive difference, a 40-year gap in time. But you look at Moses when he was in Egypt, self-cocky, there was a sense of bravado. Now, he's scared out of his wits. Who am I that I should go? That bravado had turned into timidity. Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? He says in verse 11 of chapter 3. Supposing I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I tell them? Verse 13. And then on into chapter 4, verse 1. What if they do not believe me or listen to me? And verse 19 of chapter 4. O Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue. See, Moses had to learn what all of us have to learn if we want to serve God. It is not all that important who you are. What is absolutely vital is who God is. And that's a lesson that all of us had to learn. It's certainly one that Moses had to learn. And that's the point of the burning bush. It's not possible according to the normal laws by which our universe is governed. And yet, here it is. The God who can do this must be great indeed. And God's first words to Moses, take off your sandals because you are standing on holy ground. There was nothing special about that ground. What made it important was the fact that the presence of God was there. And when Moses complains, God says, throw down your staff and it becomes a snake. Now pick it up by the tail and it becomes a stick again. Stick your hand under your robe. Now take it out and it's covered in leprosy. Put it back and it's healed. What's the point of all of this? not to beat Moses into submission, but to help him to see that the God who has called him is able to do what he's asking him to do. To help him to see that his self-doubts don't disqualify him from ministry and from service, precisely because the God who has called him is more than able to do all of these things. People continue to look for better methods. God persists in developing better people. People who see something of his greatness and who are prepared to trust him. Now, I'm fairly sure that if I had been on the committee appointing a liberator for the Jews, I would have gone to Moses and say, you know, Moses, you're just the guy we've been looking for. I've been reading your resume and it's really good. You know how to speak the language. You've lived with a foot in both camps. You know what it means to lead a nation. You're exactly the guy we want. But God says, Moses, your self-doubts are entirely justified, but I'm exactly the God you need. Our strengths don't guarantee our success, but neither do our self-doubts disqualify us from serving God. This is something, I suppose, that I identify. It's the part of Moses' story that I most identify with. One of my earliest childhood memories is sitting in the principal's office in school and listening to the principal say to my mother, what you have to understand, Mrs. Miller, is that Robert is retarded and he will never learn anything. Way to bolster your confidence. And I remember as a child being put in the back of the classroom to play with toys while the other kids learned stuff. And then I had this sense that God was leading me into ministry. And my concern, in many ways, was not about the drop in income or the lack of a pension. Is what do I have to offer? What can I do? Yeah, I'd graduated from high school, but, you know, still a retard in my mind. That was how I saw myself. And God brought people into my life that would help me to see exactly what Moses had to learn, that it matters less who I am, but what's vital is who he is. And I went to Bible school and I did okay. Then I went on and worked on a master's. And I have this distinct memory. I had to finish my last course by correspondence. And I mailed the envelope, and as I heard the envelope hit the bottom of the mailbox, I thought, this is where they'll find out how stupid I am. This is where it will all come unglued. And it didn't matter that I'd gone through my entire master's program with an A-minus average. I still didn't quite get it. And 24 years ago, I became the pastor of a church. And I stood in the pulpit on the first Sunday. And I thought to myself, are you nuts? What do you have to offer these people? Every Sunday you have to stand up and teach them something. Are you nuts? And every day I have to learn that same lesson. Our self-doubts do not disqualify us from service. Because something I've learned is that almost every Sunday for that 24 years, I have stood in a pulpit somewhere, and God has given me what I need. Because it doesn't matter what I can do and what I can't do. What matters is what God can do. And some of you may be facing exactly that same dilemma. And all I can say to you is learn the lesson that Moses learned and learn the lesson that I've had to learn. That with God, all things are possible. That's why the Apostle Paul, generations after Moses, would make this observation. God has chosen the foolish things of this world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of the world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. Because the reality is, whenever we set out to serve God, the task is always greater than our abilities. And whatever your circumstances, whatever you're facing, wherever you've come from, that is a single universal truth. God will always do far more than you can ask or even imagine. And the tasks he calls you to are always greater than your ability. Philip Brooks, writing about prayer and about ministry, made this observation. Do not pray for easy lives. Pray to be stronger people. Do not pray for tasks equal to your powers. Pray for powers equal to your tasks. And then you will not, then your work will not be a miracle. You will be the miracle. And every day and in every way you will wonder at the grace of God that has come to you through Jesus Christ. Our strengths do not guarantee our success. Our weaknesses and our self-doubts do not disqualify us from service. And so Moses goes, trusting God. He confronts Pharaohs, confounds Egypt's magicians, declares God's power, sees God's work, leads the people out of Egypt and out of slavery. And there were so many high points in his story. The power and the judgment of God is seen in the 10 plagues. The power and protection of God in the crossing of the Red Sea. The righteousness of God in the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. The grace of God in allowing Moses to see something of God's glory. The generosity of God in providing for the children of Israel through those wilderness wanderings, in spite of their complaints and their disobedience. And at the center of it all was Moses. But in that we see God's relentless determination to make us better people. Way on in the story, toward the end of Moses' life, in the book of Numbers, there's a sad episode. The people are complaining. There's no water. And their complaint is, as it has been through almost 40 years of wandering, have you brought us into the wilderness so we can die of thirst? And God says, take your rock, go and speak to this rock, and water will come out. A similar incident had happened a few years previously. Numbers chapter 20 and verse 1. In the first month, the whole Israelite community arrived in the desert of Sin, and they stayed at Kadesh. There Miriam died and was buried. Now there was no water for the community, and the people gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron. They quarreled with Moses and said, if only we had died when our brothers fell dead before the Lord. Why did you bring the Lord's community into this desert that we and our livestock should die here? Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to this terrible place? It has no grain or figs, grapevines or pomegranates, and there is no water to drink. Moses and Aaron went from the assembly to the entrance of the tent of meeting and fell face down, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. See, God's reminding them of his greatness. The Lord said to Moses, take the staff, and you and your brother Aaron gather the assembly together. Speak to that rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. You will bring water out of the rock for the community. So they did, and their livestock can drink. So Moses took the staff from the Lord's presence, just as he had commanded him. And he and Aaron gathered the assembly together in front of the rock. And Moses said to them, listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock? Then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock twice with his staff. Water gushed out, and the community and their livestock drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not trust in me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I give them." These were the waters of Meribah, where the Israelites quarreled with the Lord, and where he showed himself holy among them. Our strengths don't guarantee our success. Our self-doubts don't disqualify us from service. But neither do our successes guarantee that we will finish well. And you see, because we are so often preoccupied with better methods, we'll turn a blind eye when corners are cut. We'll let integrity slip just a little bit. But because God is concerned with developing better people, he never will. And he is relentless in that. Now, it's not quite clear how what Moses did constituted a lack of trust. God had very clearly said, "Speak to the rock." And Moses struck it. And he declares in his anger, "Must we bring water out of this rock?" But faith is expressed in two ways, not just in trust, but also in obedience. And Moses had disregarded God's word, God's instructions. The psalmist says, "By the waters of Meribah, they angered the Lord, and trouble came to Moses because of them, for they rebelled against the Spirit of God, and rash words came from Moses' lips." Faith is expressed not just in trust, but also in obedience. And just because Moses had done all of these things, God was relentless to the end of his life in shaping him and molding him and making him the man that he wanted to be. And God will do the same for you and for me. Because you see, he's not interested in better methods. He's not interested in our power. He wants to help us see who he is, so that we can serve him as he desires. What does all this teach us about God? It points us to a God who is first of all great enough not to be bound by our expectations. A God who is great enough not to be particularly impressed by our talents, because he gave them to us in the first place. A God who is great enough not to be in need of our gifts, or limited by our weakness, or even thwarted by our disobedience. It points us to a God who is righteous enough to hold us to account and who will work to make us men and women of faith. It points us to a God who is gracious enough to be patient with our weakness, to develop our character, to stand us up when we fall down. Moses, in his strengths, in his self-doubts, in his successes, and indeed in his failures, shows us that while we may continue to go in search of better methods, God is relentless in seeking to make us better people.